to the History of Arta podcast.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
We are your hosts, Dean.
And Alex.
And we are here to talk about the Rings of Power. We are now on episode 5 of our response and our deep dive into this show.
And it's our least favorite episode yet.
Well, yeah. In some ways it's the worst, some ways it's the best. We've got some things to talk about.
There were some good scenes. There are some scenes I really, really liked.
Before we get into discussion of the actual episode, I do want to point out something. I meant to talk about this in a previous episode. So the first time we saw the opening cinematic was in episode 2, and the pilot didn't have this opening, but every episode since has the cinematic, you know, alongside Howard Shore's original song for the show. One cool thing is that the inspiration behind this, what it looks like as you're watching, is sort of like sand moving around on the screen, and it creates different images. There's obviously the two trees, and there's lots of circular images, which are reminiscent of the Rings of Power. But when the creators of this title sequence were talking in an interview about their inspiration, they made reference to Chladni figures. This is it's a phenomenon called cymatics, or the visual representation of sound in the way that it moves through objects like sand. And sound is so important in Tolkien's universe because, as we know, the universe was created by music. This phenomenon was first, at least in recorded history, was first discovered by an English scientist named Robert Hooke. And he took a violin bow and ran it along the edge of a flower-covered glass plate and noticed that it was doing some really interesting patterns. So then Ernst Chladni is the one that we associate with it today. Chladni figures are what we're seeing in that opening sequence. And I thought it was kind of interesting, a whole other thing that we can't dive into now, but Chladni figures actually are known to be related to the solutions of the Schrödinger equation for one electron atoms. And the mathematics describing them was used by Erwin Schrödinger to arrive at the understanding of electron orbitals. So wild, it's all connected. So Schrödinger apparently knew that the Ainur actually created the universe. That's clearly what I'm getting at here. So diving into the actual episode 5, this episode was titled Partings. I think it'd be easiest to tackle each of the storylines. What we'll do is kind of tackle the Harfoots as a storyline, the Southlands as a storyline, and Numenor as a storyline, and Lindon as a fourth. Mm-hmm. These are the four stories that are running simultaneously. So instead of jumping from scene to scene, we'll kind of go through each of the stories. We start in the episode with the Harfoots, so we'll kind of follow their story through. We missed them in episode 4, so they were back.
There were some such cute scenes too when Nori's teaching the stranger English and he's like, I'm Peril. I'm like, oh
yeah. In the opening, what was the little thing that he was saying? My great thumb, because he can't say migration.
It's cute. I like so it. Good. He gets all excited about the snails. I'm just like, ah.
As Alex mentioned, you know, they have a discussion of what the word peril means. And she says it's, you know, Nori is explaining to him it means to make something dead. And he's thinking, I'm peril, because he remembers the fireflies. And she's like, no, this is just an accident. You're not a peril. You're good. You're here to help.
It was adorable.
So there's a musical sequence in the opening with the song that apparently was Poppy's mother's song, her walking song, which we've talked about from the soundtrack. That was my favorite moment of the episode. It was really, even though I've heard the song many times now, that got me really teary.
I saw some posts on Twitter too of people just being like, I didn't really care for the song on the soundtrack, but now like having it in the episode, they really liked it.
Yeah. And it was just an absolutely gorgeous shot of them walking, mm-hmm. like on location.
That kind of blew my mind of how far they're actually migrating. It seems like crazy distance.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and one of the places that they go on this migration is famous from Lord of the Rings. They go to a place that on the map is called the Grey Marshes, which we know from Lord of the Rings as the Dead Marshes. It's the place that Sam and Frodo and Gollum go, and there's lots of dead bodies all over. And that's because the final battle that will end this TV show, The Rings of Power, is where, an enormous number of people are going to die right there. And,
Oh, that's where it's fought.
yeah, well, the entire battle isn't fought there, but
Right.
that's a place where there's a mass amount of people killed. But I love the whole opening sequence, the song, but even more so the relationship of the stranger to the rest of the Harfoots now. Just seeing him, like that scene where they're just the whole family is together and they're kind of like all laughing and goofing around. And then in the background, there's the stranger, like four times bigger than all of them, and just like looking in on the scene from without and then kind of wandering off and looking, at the stars and the moon. And it makes me think of something that's from Frankenstein, actually. Not so much in the book, but particularly in like the theatrical, the Benedict Cumberbatch version of Frankenstein. There's this really, really sad and beautiful whole sequence where Frankenstein is watching this family from the outside and how joyful they are. And he is this strange outsider creature who doesn't understand himself. He doesn't know. He's learning language from the family. Unfortunately, the Frankenstein story ends in tragedy because he has the advantage of at first talking to a blind man who just can't see his ugly looking appearance. So he teaches him language and they read books together and they have deep philosophical discussions. But when the son of this old man comes home and finds that he's actually a terrifying monster, it ends badly and the guy burns down the house and kills the family. So hopefully the stranger doesn't become a psychotic murderer.
I don't know,
But
there's still time.
yeah. I mean, honestly, for those who are in the with the stranger is Sauron camp, that's exactly where we're headed. He'll definitely have to betray the Harfoots and perhaps kill some to inspire enough hatred for the character of Sauron that we would need. Here's hoping he's, I mean, between the two, I would take Gandalf over Sauron, but yes, I would still take the Blue Wizards or some other new idea over.
What do you think's up with the little stranger cult?
Oh, I don't know.
We know they're after him.
Yeah, it seems as though they are a cult that knows who the stranger is and has been seeking him. And one thing that's very easy to miss is that there are three cultists in the scene. There's the main one who seems to sort of be leading them, who was mistakenly believed to be Anson Boone slash Sauron. Bridie Sisson is the actress playing that character. One of the other cultists,
On the back
priestesses.
of that, like, moon shield. Yeah, they have the constellation on there. I shared a screenshot on
Ah,
Twitter.
okay. Yeah, so it's that constellation that the stranger has been apparently seeking, has been trying to draw and everything. And so I'm going, oh, there is a connection. So is he seeking these cultists? Are the cultists seeking him because of his knowledge of something related to the constellation? Are they all headed to the same place? Who knows? But the cultists appear and they are investigating the spot where he landed on Earth, on Arda. And interesting. And for those of you who, like Alex, like the idea of the man in the moon came down too soon, there's a
That's
lot of
where it went.
evidence in this episode for that theory.
That's where my mind went.
And I still haven't ruled that out. I don't subscribe to some of
Man on the
the
moon pile.
right. Yeah, I don't subscribe to some of the wilder theories though, like he's a Balrog in human form, Yeah,
What?
there's some stuff I've been hearing and I'm like, no, guys, no. It's he sure he's a Maia and I think he's an Istari, but
This is some Tyrion as a Targaryen shit.
right. So, continuing the Harfoot story later in the episode, Malva, who is sort of working as an antagonist against Poppy and Nori throughout the story, sort of whispering in the ear of Sadok. Malva wants the Brandyfoots to be left behind. She says to Sadok, take the wheels from their cart, leave them before we have more widows made
they're
or whatever.
Really superstitious. I don't think that's something we've like really touched on the podcast yet with the Harfoots, but it came up in an earlier episode where Poppy and Nori are talking like, oh, they'll blame every bad thing that happens on us for the next 10 years.
The next three seasons, which was a meta joke.
Oh, yeah, the next three seasons. Yeah, exactly. Like, stuff like that. Like, they're really, really superstitious. Like, you have to do things the right way or stuff's just going to start going wrong. And stuff has been going wrong when the stranger tags along. So, yeah, they're like, all right, let's just leave the Brandyfoots behind. The entire family with all those children. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you, the Harfoots are dark.
Yeah, but Sadok is resistant to the idea, and he vouched for them once before against the others and said, you know, they can still come with us. They'll be at the back. And now when he's being asked to just take their wheels off their cart and leave them behind, he's like, no, they can still come along. And thankfully, they've got the stranger to help pull them out of the muck in the swamp and drag the cart when no one else can and so on. So. But Malva is then, you know, out gathering mushrooms in the woods, and Poppy and Nori come running up to tell her they've seen evidence of some wolves in the woods, and before you know it, all three of them are being chased by three wolves.
Why are the wolves so weird? Why aren't they just normal wolves?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Why, though?
Right.
I get like, oh, fantasy series, but also, why? Right. What's the point of this?
Yeah, they're strange looking. They're maybe evolutionary ancestors of wolves with teeth that come out of their lower jaws. I don't know. But the stranger comes in, grabs one wolf and throws it, and then uses a kind of, seems to use his power to force the three of them back all at the same time.
It seemed like wind.
Yeah.
Because we've seen a lot of him doing stuff with like wind blowing through trees and all those things. So I thought,
Right, exactly. That's good. Like, good point. Wind. Yeah, the wind blowing through the trees. We've also seen him, of course, sort of using fire, if we count using the fireflies, and of course the fire that involuntarily came out of his body.
Using the fireflies does not count as using fire. That's talking to bugs.
Fair enough. At least we've seen the fire that came out of him as he came crashing down to Earth. And then in this episode, he's using his ice powers.
Right.
So we've got, like, you know, three of the elements, I guess, at least.
Yeah, dude.
So... yeah, when he blows the wolves away.
You see he's injured by that. He's got, like, his veins kind of go black. And something I noticed with the cultist, at least the lead one, when he's touching the dirt there, his fingertips are all black like that.
Oh, really?
Like, maybe they are using... something about using this power can, like, harm the body, is my take.
Well...
it was subtle. It wasn't in your face. But, yeah, the cultist's fingertips are also kind of black like that. So I wonder if it's... yeah, who knows?
I am not a big fan of D&D style magic being used in Tolkien's universe. And if there are any characters who are going to use D&D style magic, I mean, that was an evolution that came along after Tolkien in the fantasy genre. Tolkien was opposed to having wizards that cast fireball and that kind of thing.
Right.
That's interesting that you know that they seem to, perhaps if these cultists are using some form of related magic, as much as we might be opposed to the idea in Tolkien's writings, that might be where they're headed with the show. This is more of a D&D style magic that people are familiar with. Besides the fact we've seen that kind of thing in the Peter Jackson films.
Part of the thing with the stranger too is his magic's so over the top right now because he can't control it.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of outbursts, just on instinct and not anything.
Right.
But it is, control.
It's an interesting twist, though, that it does seem to cause some injury to the body to use it, which would give an in-universe explanation in this show of why don't the wizards constantly use their power.
Right.
Without getting into the metaphysical explanations or reasons of Tolkien, we can just say, well, because it obviously screws them up pretty bad, you would just kill yourself if you used too much power. You know, we can just sort of retcon and say we never saw Gandalf's arm shriveling up, but perhaps it did underneath his robe, you know, when he used his magic occasionally. So his arm is pretty messed up and
heals
himself, apparently.
Ice.
Yeah, he puts his arm in the water and this causes ice to start forming around the arm.
This is what was confusing because Nori was freaking out when her arm gets trapped in the ice. But when it breaks out, she's like not harmed or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But she's still really freaked out.
Yeah, it's similar to the fact that she wasn't, you know, she could have stood in the fire that the stranger was casting when he landed and not been burned. She said it's not hot, in the same way that the cold scares her, but it doesn't seem to hurt her in any way. She actually comes into this scene to tell the stranger that he has one favor among the other Harfoots, that they're all really impressed with the fact that he saved Malva and the other two young Harfoots. And she's like, you know, it's a big deal. They all think they're really, you know, excited by what you did. And then she notices his arm sort of covered in ice and the water on a balmy day in the forest.
To be fair, it was kind of stupid to touch the magic ice.
Yeah.
Maybe don't do that.
Yeah.
I'm victim blaming.
Yeah. He starts speaking in another language again.
Did we get translations?
Not yet. The only word that I thought I could make out in all of that was like Vinyatar, which I don't think that's actually what he said. But Vinyatar, if that is what he said, would translate into young noble or young king. Vinya is young youth in Quenya, and Tar is the word for king.
Do we know what language he was speaking?
In the previous episode, the stranger was speaking Quenya. So I won't rule out that he's speaking Quenya again, but I will say that I don't know. He was actually saying Vinyatar, among other garbled things. Hopefully somebody can make out something that he was saying there.
I'm sure we'll have a translation.
We had the assistance of subtitles, I think, on the previous episode, and this time we didn't. It just said speaking another language.
A lot of the times I've noticed with the subtitles, though, they don't.
And a note on the Quenya that's actually being used. Most of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films were very Sindarin heavy. And so it's interesting to see the Quenya and Elvish being focused on more. And I have to assume...
It makes sense, though, because it's like thousands of years in the past.
Yeah, and I'm going to assume that's why they made that decision, is that, you know, we want to be in a more ancient past. Therefore, we'll use the equivalent of Elf Latin. But... according to canon, that still shouldn't be the case. Sindarin was pretty much always spoken by any of the common elves. And in fact, Quenyan was like forbidden to be spoken by the king of what we might call Western Middle Earth in the First Age. And from that point on, it became the language of lore only, and only like the high lords spoke it privately in their own homes. So the fact that like characters like Arondir, who is a Sylvan elf, that he would speak it as his like... normal day-to-day Elvish language seems to me wrong, but that he would know it does seem to me correct. Like, he was born in Beleriand. He and Adar would definitely could have had a conversation in Quenya, but I think it would be inaccurate if, like, he went back and hung out with the other Sylvan elves and they were all chatting it up in Quenyan. I think that would be when they would break out the Sindarin, which is, like, the difference between speaking in Latin and speaking in a modern functional language that was based off of Latin, like one of the Romance languages, you know, speaking Spanish or Italian or Portuguese.
I think that's what they're going for.
Yeah. So I think it's just to show that there's a big difference in time here. There's a lot more Quenya being thrown around, and it's a prettier language when you get the chance to use it. Why wouldn't you? So, I mean, it's Quenya's gorgeous. Anyway, so yeah, that wraps up the Harfoot story.
Forever, they're done, they're off the show.
That's it.
Bye.
So what's happening in the Southlands? So the first thing we see in the Southlands is Adar enjoying the sunlight. The orcs can't do this. And
yeah, I know, he's kind of like a sociopath in this scene where he's like, oh, you feel that, buddy? Oh yeah, it's burning you? Gosh. Yeah. Well, I wish you could feel it how I feel it, as he's still holding his arm right in the sun. And it's like, what the Dude, chill out. Chill out.
Wish you could feel it like I feel it, because pretty soon we won't be able to again. And the orcs are like, great, sign me up. That sounds wonderful. He knows what we know as viewers of Lord of the Rings, that we are all living very near to a Rod Ruin or Mount Doom. And soon that sucker is going to blow up, and it's going to create an ash cloud that will block out the sun so the orcs can roam Mordor freely.
I thought he was talking literal, like he wants to take out the sun, kind of like taking out, like turning off all the lanterns and then killing the trees. Morgoth like it dark.
He doesn't have quite that level of power yet, though.
Right, but he wants to be a god.
He does say he wants to be a god.
He wants to make a whole new world.
Right. Yeah. So if we, now, that's an interesting point, because we don't actually know what Adar's motivations are. He seems to be leading the orcs to accomplish what apparently Sauron set in motion with that symbol, which is to create a safe space for the orcs, right? To create a place where the orcs can thrive. But Adar has never said explicitly himself that that's what he's up to. And in fact, we'll talk about later in this Southland section that we might have reason to suspect the synergy between Sauron and Adar, and whether or not Adar really is working for Sauron, or maybe he's working against him. I don't know. It's not clear. But I guess without thinking too deeply into it, I kind of assumed, okay, he's making a reference here to the fact that this land is going to be very dark in the very near future, because he knows about the coming explosion of Mount Doom and the creation of Mordor. But yeah. Now, one thing we haven't talked about before, we could have mentioned this in the previous episode too, but the outfit that Adar is wearing, particularly I noticed this with the kind of metal collar around his neck in this costume, is identical to the one that Gil-galad wears. And very, very similar in style to the outfits of both Gil-galad and Elrond.
Gil-galad is Adar, confirmed.
Right. And yeah, so Elrond and Gil-galad were both born in Beleriand in the First Age. We've heard Arandir say, "I was born in Beleriand." That's the same place both of these characters, Elrond and Gil-galad, were born. And they were also born, by the way, we don't know where Gil-galad was born, but Elrond was born at the mouths of the river Sirion. And what's interesting is, even though they never say the name Sirion, when Adar is talking to Arandir in the previous episode, he says, you were born at the mouth of the river. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a pointed thing for Tolkien fans to be like, they're talking about the mouths of Sirion, which was an important place at the end of the First Age, a final haven for all elves after most of their strongholds had been destroyed. That's where Elrond lived. Apparently that's where Arandir may have also lived, and this character Adar. So it makes sense that if they're all coming from this period of the First Age and from the same geographical location, which is now sunk underwater, that they would all maybe be wearing the same kinds of armor, the same kind of outfit.
Or we're going with the multi-timeline theory, which is my personal favorite, and Adar is Gil-galad confirmed.
Even though they're totally separate actors and
yeah,
don't look anything like...
He gets older.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
He gets like a real bad beatdown.
But we do need to come back to the multiple timelines theory at least once more in this episode, because I'm giving it some credence.
I know. Yeah. The way that... All right, we'll get there.
We'll get there. Yeah, and I have at least one Reddit comment I want to call out on that subject. So also in the Southlands, we come back to Bronwyn, who is now speaking to the people gathered at Os Tirith, this tower where they're gathering for refuge. She shares the message that Arandir brought from Adar, which is that Adar is coming for us. He's going to come and claim this tower, and he says, if we leave this place, forsake these lands, and swear fealty to him, we'll be okay, but otherwise we'll probably all die. She offers to lead the people to fight, to resist. And Waldreg, our old buddy, the old man who's been chatting up Theo, Bronwyn's son, Waldreg comes down and he says, look, they're clearly going to win. If we just come, if we join them, if we swear fealty, and this is what he wants us to do, they'll let us live.
Also pretty just damn enthusiastic, like...
Yeah, he's a big fan of Sauron, and he thinks that this
guy
really
is
Sauron.
He's not really making a secret of it in the scene either, when he's convincing everyone, like, come on, guys, we gotta get our power back, and that kind of shit.
Right. Yeah, and it's been pretty clear through certain characters in the South that they're all waiting for their king to return. And we know now from the Galadriel and Halbrand story that the king that they're all referring to was a servant of Morgoth. Like, the ancestors in the past all worked for Morgoth. And this is part of the reason Halbrand claims that he doesn't want anything to do with his ancestry, because he's like, they were all terrible people. And so was I. And let's come back to that. But yes, so Waldreg is like, whatever Adar wants. And again, we'll come back to this in just a second, but Waldreg has been waiting for the return of Sauron, not just for a human king, but this Maia, this mm-hmm. all-powerful figure, Sauron, who he believes Adar is. And we've seen this already before. The other Sylvan elves all thought the same thing. Maybe this Adar character is Sauron by another name. I think it's pretty clear by this episode, this is not Sauron we're seeing. This is a different character. Who he is and what his relationship is the next mystery, but this is not Sauron.
I don't know. It seemed he didn't really confirm or deny it, and I could see actual Sauron being pissed that just some like lowly human dude is calling him by his name, especially if he's kind of keeping it under wraps and using the name Adar at the time.
Yeah.
The attitude there. It didn't rule out for me that he's Sauron.
Well, let's come to that moment. And there's one scene I don't want to skip because it actually was the second moment that got me teary. But it was the moment when Waldreg is like walking away and he's calling out to Theo, like, come on, Theo, this is our moment. Like, this is our time. And the feeling of Theo in that moment, I guess, was really like powerful to me. I guess I felt the tug of this character, like, am I faithful to my mother and to the people who are probably all going to die here in defense of this tower? Or do I go the easy road? Do I go the powerful road, the place where I know I can fit in and belong and probably with the big bad guys that are going to win, but something that I clearly know is not good? Like, you know, he has a conscience about it. And I like that this show is setting up these big, obvious choices for characters. We saw this with, like, Galadriel standing on the ship, and a lot of people don't like this scene, but I really love the emotional, like, tug of war that's happening. Do I go to Valinor? Do I go back to Middle-earth? Right in that moment, you just see this struggle happening on her face. And I feel like for just a little second, the same thing's happening with Theo. As he's like, Waldreg will accept me. I have the power of this amazing magical blade. Clearly the orcs are going to kill everyone. I should go with them. But like, I know it's not right. And my mother is here. And then, you know, by the end of the episode, he's building a relationship with Arondir.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, these are my people. And yeah, we'll come back and talk a little bit more about Theo, but I like that moment. And he does decide to stay, and Rowan goes with Waldreg.
I'm confused plot-wise, too. They're holed up in this tower. They've already left their town. There's a third option here of just get out of Dodge. Go get out of the area. I mean, at least go try to convince, like, the elves or other men, somebody, like, hey, shit's going down. Help us.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to just hole up there. They could leave. They could go.
Yeah, no, it is a plot hole in a way that they haven't, I don't think, filled satisfactorily.
No, they have no motivation to just camp out there and stay.
Right. Now, people were coming in from all over the place, she said, from every village from here to Aradruin, or what will become Mount Doom. So supposedly a ton of people have been gathering in this one place, but you're not wrong that she could say, we should scoot 20 miles to the west.
Right, exactly. You've already been going. Just keep it up.
We've already abandoned your homes to come here.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Just keep going. They haven't really filled it.
And why we haven't seen Arondir contacting Gil-galad and being like,
and reaching out to the elves,
we need some help,
especially when he should know what a big deal is. It is because like Galadriel was on like a wild goose chase and everyone knew it, of just like, come on,
right,
the orcs are gone. Now there's a horde of orcs and he's just like really taking it in stride, of just like, oh man,
why he doesn't then go like, but this is much more serious than what we were even here to watch for, right? We were here watching for the betrayal of humans.
It's not like he saw like, oh, there's like one or two orcs that made it out. All right, one thing. There's a literal army of them. He sees what they're doing. He sees these tunnels, how they're tunneling all over the Southlands.
Yeah.
He knows this is a big deal. Why isn't there any urgency to like go get help? He's not even sending someone else. I get him maybe being like, I need to stay here.
Right.
But why not send messengers? What is going on?
Right. Yeah. Well, we've got to have another Helm's Deep moment. You know, we've got to, like, this is our last ditch defense. We have to defend this tower. But I think...
But it's just some random tower. It's not even their tower. It's the Elves' Watchtower.
Right.
That hasn't been used by humans in 70 years. There's no emotional connection. It's not like, this is our city. We've got to defend our city. This is our last stronghold. None of them there have a connection to it. It's where all these refugees fled.
So Waldrick goes to Adar. He leads about half of the people from Mos Tirith to Adar. And he makes the mistake of saying, I pledge my loyalty to Sauron. Or it seems to be a mistake because of the way that Adar reacts. Because he like choke slams him into the ground. Because Adar doesn't say anything at all. Whether or not he's actually been angered by the, you know, by Waldrick calling him Sauron is the question in the scene. And that's how I interpreted this. So maybe Adar and Sauron don't have a good history together. Maybe there's some competition between them, or maybe Adar just doesn't want to be considered as serving Sauron. I mean, maybe Adar was so messed up by Morgoth that he doesn't have any good feeling towards Sauron, and perhaps Adar will be a kind of ally in the future. Who knows?
Yeah, at this point, nobody's motivations are clear.
Yeah. As we said, Waldrick thinks that that Adar is Sauron, and then when he starts realizing that this is not Sauron after all, he's like, I'll serve you then, whoever you are. Mm-hmm. He's like, don't take offense, you know? We can be friends. And at this point, Adar still seems angry, and he sort of, you know, he violently throws Waldrick on the ground, and then he grabs Rowan and gives Waldrick a blade, and he says only blood can bind, and Waldrick is only too willing to commit murder, it seems, although we never see the actual murder happens as the scene ends, so we don't know if that's because of, you know, it's too gory to show on screen, or whether we may still see Rowan again, and Waldrick didn't in fact kill him. Don't know yet.
So, I saw it on Twitter, but people are speculating that this might actually be a flashback. The whole Southlands plot might be a flashback to Halbrand's past, just because of the way the scene is cut when he later in Numenor is talking to Galadriel about how I've done some bad shit, like, we've done some bad shit. And it's all while this scene, it's like cutting back and forth. I think the other possibility, if they're not doing a time jump, is it's definitely going to come out that Halbrand himself, like, swore fealty to this group. Maybe not Adar himself, but, like, whatever, like, shit's going down in the Southlands. At one point in time, I think he was working with them.
Yeah.
If, at least for his own survival.
Right. And you speculated in a previous episode, a reaction recording that we did, that there could be a time jump going on, and I think that's a really interesting idea. I think
we were talking about it jokingly. Like, the time frame with the elves right now, and Celebrimbor making the rings is kind of funky, and we were talking about time jumps there. But I think it's totally possible they could pull a Westworld.
Yeah. In fact, just today on Reddit, I saw another similar, time jump theory. And this person on Reddit, on LOTR on Prime, named Potter's Socks.
Potter's Socks.
What if all the signs that the stranger were Annatar was true? What if the writers pulled a Witcher and the Harfoot Stranger plotline happened way before all others, since it's one of the most isolated plotlines in the series? Then in a future episode, when it's revealed what is actually going on behind Gil-galad and Celebrimbor's secret grand plan, we see the stranger, clean and shaven, have been whispering to both of them all along.
Oh.
Cut to credits, end of episode. You know, so another similar idea based on what we'll talk about shortly, you know, about Celebrimbor and Gil-galad's motivations. But again, the theory of a time jump, you know, right in front of our eyes this whole time. I would not put it past the writers, and I think that's a really exciting idea, and I would love to see some form of that play out.
It's almost too exciting in the fact that I don't think they'll do. Like, it won't I think they'll disappoint
and we'll
me.
All be disappointed.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Especially since it's been done, you know, not just right. The Witcher, but Westworld plays with that a whole lot. It's not as much of a gotcha now.
Yep. Before we leave the Southlands, a couple more things happen. Arondir is teaching Theo to shoot a bow. And he starts, you know, Theo's like, what are you still doing around here? You elves watch us, you know, if we've sharpened our kitchen knives too much, you're on our case, right? You've watched us for hundreds of years now. And it's like,
yeah, I've watched you for hundreds of years now.
And that's exactly what he replies, right? He's like, I've been watching you and I see the people behind those knives now. Is what his line is, something like that. And that's why he's decided to stay at the tower rather than leave them. And Theo still questions that. And he's like, half of us just left to basically go serve Sauron or whoever. And then Arondir's like, but half also stayed, including you. So
real half glass, half full.
Yeah, right. So get back to your bow training.
Are you a half left to serve Sauron or a half stayed to fight kind of guy?
Yeah. Now Theo reveals that he has the hilt to Arondir, which I think this is a big move and very cool of him to be like...
I didn't think they would come out this soon. I thought he was going to discover it on him and there'd be the whole like, oh gosh, yeah. Can I even
which
trust
is
you?
Like, so you know. Predictable, right? Yeah. It's very cool for him to just straight out, you know, like I like that Theo's kind of coming back to the light now and he's chosen not to go with Waldrig, and now he's showing Arondir, he's trusting Arondir, which is great.
He wants a dad.
Yeah, and I like that. Like, I think it's just too predictable to have this kid go down the dark road, and oh gosh, you know, and he's... So if he is going to become a Ring Wraith, or the Witch King, or some other dark figure in the future, I want it to be painful, and so I need him to be good in the meantime.
You know? Yeah.
So, anyway, but then Arondir's like, man, I recognize this, and starts clearing away some vines, and weirdly enough, in an elvish watchtower, there's this very scary-looking head kind of thing with, like, a sword that looks like the one that Theo has driving down into a human figure.
Because they don't have the internet of, like, hey, I recognize this, plug it into Google. It's gonna be on the statue that's conveniently right there.
Yeah, so why did the elves put this in Os Tirith, in this elvish watchtower? Is this just to remember something that happened in the past? It looks awfully sinister to be, you know, like, elvish decoration, so. But Arondir calls this, when he's talking to Bronwyn, he calls this blade... a key to enslave your ancestors. And she asks, a key to what? He doesn't know. But he repeats to her what he heard from Adar. Things like Adar wants to become a god and give the orcs a place to thrive. But he needs this hilt to enact the plan. He also tells Bronwyn that Adar knows your son has the hilt and they're coming for him and it. So again, if we're trying to be proactive about this, we might take it away from him at this point and get it to somebody who can maybe not die
right
as easily. But then this is where they say we have days, maybe hours, and they look into the valley and they can see the torches coming towards the tower. And this is where Bronwyn falls into a pit of despair as they're talking about this. She's like, suddenly, as she's, you know, looking at the torches and everything, she's like, we can't do this. And she suddenly starts to think that Waldrig's plan wasn't so bad after all. And he falls after her and he's like, no, don't fall into despair. Like, you can't choose for your entire people just because you're afraid and you feel like there's no hope. There's got to be another way.
And I didn't like this scene, though.
Oh, this is one of the highlights of the episode for me, just because of the way she phrases this. It fits so well with the lore that's been established. She says, you were right to watch us, because we were destined for the darkness. It's how we survive. And that, to me, makes so much sense when we go back to those lore episodes we did before starting to review the show itself. We talked about, I think... particularly in the Akalabeth, they talk about how humans were always the most susceptible to Morgoth's plans. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why? You know, why? Mm-hmm. Why do humans have such a bad rap? We always, you know, there's no nobility in mankind. You know, all of Middle Earth until the Numenoreans return, it just falls to Sauron or to Morgoth. You know, But then Bronwyn gives to me like the most, you know, understandable reason for that. She's like, this is how we survive. It's not just that we're cowards or that we're cavemen that get pushed around by big dark lords. It's like we are savvy and smart enough to know how to survive, and sometimes surviving means bowing to the enemy. So those who have the power, instead of getting wiped off the face of the earth. It's how we survive. Perhaps it's who we are, who we will always be.
Okay, I got crazy. All right, so we're saying that time jumps, right? Possibly.
Yeah.
And Bronwyn was like, I know I'm not the king you guys have been waiting for, but like, mm-hmm. here I am. What if, Halbrand is Theo? What if, the Swaperoonie there. If so, because it's got to be one of the Southlanders. Like, if this is mm-hmm. what's going on, it's yeah. someone alive at that time, younger.
Yeah.
Why not Theo?
The one piece of evidence I can think of that fits well with that theory, very well with that theory, is that people have, without ever coming up with any idea like that before, people suspected that Halbrand and Bronwyn were, like, Halbrand was Theo's father, and that Halbrand and Bronwyn were once together, because the thing he wears around his neck is not only the sigil, the little symbol, the metal symbol we keep seeing, there's also a little pouch behind it that seems to contain a bottle. And the first time you see it, it looks very similar to the bottle that Bronwyn gave to Arondir in that same episode that contained flowers from Beleriand. And so I have to believe that Halbrand has had some interaction with Bronwyn, whether he was a past lover or whether he's her son, which I think is even more on the mark. Like, yeah, that would work.
Right.
And he's talking yeah. about what he did to survive because he is Theo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Theo Halbrand. That's his full name. that's a great. I like that one a lot.
What's Theo short for, buddy? Oh, it's short for Thelbrand.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if those two actors look enough alike for it to be believable, but then again, they pulled that on us in Westworld, and a lot of people say, well, Ed Harris doesn't look very much like
Don't look anything alike.
Yeah, so could be.
I don't know, sometimes casting is really off when it's like older, younger actors.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, but I think
I don't know.
I do think all the fans are onto something, though, that cut when Halbrand is later narrating and we cut back to seeing Waldrick and
there's
the rest,
some connection there.
That is a little bit suspicious. Like, that seems like a clue.
I would say Halbrand is Theo's father is another contender. Yeah, like, maybe he took off.
I'm not ruling it out. Yeah. Yeah, that's been out since the first time we saw Halbrand. They were like, what are you running from, buddy? Like, do you happen to have, like, a kid back home? So, yeah. Anyway, that theory does... Or Bronwyn's lines here and her feeling of despair and her explanation for, like, the way that humans are fits really well with the lore as we've discussed it.
I think it would fit really well if she's Halbrand's mom.
Yeah. Now, Arondir goes on to say in reply to her despair talk, he says, look, there's more than just our lives at stake here. You got to remember, back when we were fighting Morgoth, an entire continent sank underwater. Mm-hmm. They've not explicitly said this at all before. Like, I got so excited in the previous episode when Arondir just mentioned the word Beleriand, and I was like, okay, so Beleriand exists, even though we've never seen it on a map. And here he says an entire, like, whole continent sank. So that's pretty much confirmation that, yeah, maybe they can't connect the dots because of rights or something, but they are basically saying, oh, Beleriand sank because we went to war with Morgoth. Cool to draw the lines there, finally. He concludes by saying, well, who knows what horrors this thing, this hilt that they're seeking, mm-hmm. might unleash if our enemy obtains it. So it's not just about our lives, it's about stopping this plot that Adar has right now.
Yeah.
And then she's like, still in her despair, she's like, the tower will fall. And then, as though they've both had a revelation, they turn and they look up at the tower. And I'm kind of going, I wonder if they can evacuate the people to just some short distance away and lure the orcs into the tower and then just knock the thing down somehow. Do they have like a secret store of dynamite somewhere we don't know about? I don't know. But they looked at it as though it was the tower itself could be like the key to a victory. And I may be misreading that, but it's an interesting pause. And everyone looks up and I was like, what are we doing?
What are they doing? What are they doing there? We're moving on.
As the orcs are headed towards that tower, they are repeating that cry that we heard them chanting at the death of the orc earlier with Adar. They're saying, Nampot, Nampot. And Nampot or Glushka, was the the chant.
Babushka.
Babushka. So, and that's the last we see of the Southlands in this episode.
Did we talk about Numenor already?
Nope, let's go to Numenor now.
So speaking of Halbrand.
Yeah, so.
He finally got his guild crest.
Yeah, right. So the first time we see Numenor, everyone's packing up to leave to go on this journey that they set up, you know.
They're going to war. They're getting ready to
go to war, yeah.
Go mess some stuff up. Boop, 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 boop,
boop. Yeah. But Isildur wants to come along, and his daddy says no. And I love this talk because, like, I felt like I sympathized a little too much with Isildur in the scene. I was like, oh, yeah, you know, he's like the good for nothing.
Yeah, I'll help out and then just bails.
Yeah, he does that. And then he's like, you know, his dad gives him, and I was like, good for you, Elendil. He like gives him the talk, like, you see all these guys over here? They earned this. You haven't done shit. Yeah. And
Elendil.
But then Isildur, if we really got to the bottom of his motivations, it's not just that he's being lazy or that he's, you know, not motivated. It's that he wants to do something quote unquote worthy of Numenor. He wants to live up to his mother's dream. And we can brush this aside like his father does in the scene and say it's a bit wishy-washy, whatever. He's being his privileged young prince self. But this, to him, going on this journey is going to be like a self-discovery. He's going to find a way to be worthy of Numenor in ways that the methods on the island so far have just not been satisfying to him. It doesn't feel like his calling.
I'm on Elendil's side.
I mean, I'm not on Elendil's side, but I see both perspectives.
Wishy-washy.
Yeah. But Elendil says, while you were feigning fidelity to the traditions of this isle, these men were living them, finding ways to contribute, to serve, something of which you evidently care little. So, can we talk about why the greatest navy on the face of the earth has 5 ships? What has happened to the lore?
Well, it turns out no one else has boats.
What is going on? We've got 5 ships in the Numenorean fleet.
Well, they're only sending 500 men.
Yeah, 100 people per boat, because that's all they can fit. Elendil says they have way more volunteers than they need, which is part of his excuse for saying Isildur's got to stay behind. But he's like, we're putting 100 men on each ship. Men and women, I should say. This is the max capacity. And I'm like, not only that, but then shortly,
which
as
also
we know,
seems ridiculous because, like, oh, we're sending this huge fort. It's 500 dudes.
Right. Yeah. It's a fleet of 500 people. Like, now, what? Now, in the lore, by the time we get to Pharazôn and Miriel, these guys have been colonizing for, you know, we're talking hundreds of years, right, that they've been landing in Middle Earth at this point. They've got this massive fleet, presumably. I've never pictured the Numenorean fleets as 5 boats. Now, I will come back to this because I think there might be a reasonable explanation for this change. Meanwhile, the contention that we hoped we were going to see, we talked about this last episode, like, why is everybody just like all of a sudden, hoorah, Miriel, let's go fight with the elves. We do see the conflict now,
yeah,
which is great.
That was
the
good.
People are rebelling.
The way it's cut, I don't know if I like it. Like, because again, end of last episode, everyone's on board. They're not doing a good job at showing the differing perspectives.
Yeah.
They segment them too much. Like, in this case, 2 entirely different episodes. And it feels too, right, like, wait, is it a change? Rather than, oh, there's differing sides of the issue.
Right. I think, like I said, my best argument for that was they wanted that nice feel-good ending to the episode last time. Like, oh, everyone's raising their hands.
I don't
need
a feel-good ending. I want things to make sense.
Yeah. Oh, I enjoyed it. But I could see that being one motivation.
You could have still had that.
We don't want to end on the same conflict we started with. We want people to actually be like, oh, they're raising their hands.
Cool. You could have still easily had that of having like the conflict first and then end on the people that do want to volunteer. Like, yeah. It's not that hard.
Right.
That's why, like, the way they keep doing this.
Just to keep that element in play, to have a bunch of people being like, boo, boo. Right. And then all of a sudden people raise their hands. Yeah.
Especially if they're like raising hands in opposition to the booers of just like, no, screw you guys. This is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Then it's even cooler and more feel good. It's like,
yeah. But at least we've gotten it, so we're not as confused once we see the conflict. Like, okay, so there are those people haven't gone away.
It's like,
So Isildur's sister is a representative of this view, where she's like, okay, what this means to me is our queen has just gone off the rails and is taking us into war. So she goes to Kemen, who is apparently Farazan's son.
My take, because at the end of last episode, you see her when everyone's like raising their hands to volunteer. Isildur raises his hand, and that's when she looks really scared and concerned. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's her necessarily being against the cause as, oh crap, my brother's going, my dad's going. I don't want my family dying in this conflict for people I don't even know. It's like when it hits home and becomes personal, because that's when she looks shocked.
I think you're right, though, that once it becomes personal,
exactly,
it's going to be more on the forefront. But I think she probably also feels generally, like politically, that we should not be doing this. So she goes to Kemen and she's like, listen, you obviously have some sway over Farazan. Why don't you talk to him? And Kemen's like, Farazan does not listen to me. If he really is Farazan's son, which it seems a little sketchy to me, if he really is, he's like, Farazan closes his ears when I'm around. But he does say to Aeorian, there are many who feel as you do. Meanwhile, Halbrand is down in the smithy making weapons, and good ones, apparently. And we're like, wait a minute now, how did he get his guild crest after all? That one that he stole and, got in a whole fight over. Clearly, that plan was never going to work out anyway. He just stole the crest. Like, he didn't earn it, right? No, nobody in any smithy is going to be
like, we joked about that. Like, he comes back 3 hours later, here I am.
Like, no one's going to buy that, right? So it turns out that this scene that, blink and you miss it, in the last episode, where the kind of goofy scene where Galadriel kind of knocks all the incompetent Numenorean guards into her prison cell and shuts the door. And Farazan starts to draw his sword. And Halbrand, the scene where I in last episode, I called it Halbrand whispering into his ear and sort of controlling him. Halbrand sort of makes a deal. We don't hear the full thing right now, but he's like, you can let her go if you knew exactly where she was going, which was him offering to give information to Farazan about what Galadriel's planning to do, which is to go find Tar Palantir in the tower and speak directly to him. So he sells Galadriel out to Farazan, and in exchange, off-screen, Farazan has given him a guild crest to be able to become a smith. And Farazan is the master of the guilds. Like, he's wearing all the gold crests. He has the power to do this, right? So it is very tricky. It's very savvy. And Galadriel, this comes into the plot of this episode when Galadriel finds out he's sold her out. She's not happy about it. So, but anyways, he's down in the smithy. He's got his guild crest now. He's making beautiful weapons, apparently. He's summoned by Miriel. He's brought before Miriel, Galadriel, Farazan, and he gives them information because they're planning an attack, in the south, in the Southlands, back in Middle-earth. And he's like, the enemy should be headed to Os Tirith. Which is interesting. It's like, he knew that. How long has he been gone from Middle-earth? But he knew that the enemy was generally headed in the direction of this tower, where they're headed at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, okay. So he knows that much.
Oh, maybe it's not different timelines.
Who knows? I mean, maybe they were headed to Os Tirith sometime in the past, and that explains the creepy statue we've got.
Oh.
It doesn't necessarily mean that the enemy wasn't headed to Os Tirith. This could be a thing to throw us off too, if the theory is correct. But he's less than enthusiastic about going back to Middle-earth. Once the rulers leave and it's just he and Galadriel, they have a conversation where, she's mad at him because he sold her out and Miriel caught her in the tower in the last episode. And then he's like, you used me too. And then she's like, no, anybody looking at this from the outside could assume you used me, because like you're the one who's going to go back to Middle Earth with 500 men, 5 ships, and a crown on your head. And once again, I'm like, only 500 men? Like,
I know, exactly.
But anyway, it's crazy. Beside the point. But yeah, so he gets angry. He takes the sigil with the little bottle or whatever he's carrying around off and slams it down on the desk and walks out. So Galadriel goes down, and down in the court in Numenor, there's a bunch of the guys that are going to be taking off soon, sword fighting each other, practicing. And she's like, these guys are as slow and sloppy as like the stone giants of the North Moors, which I think is a cute reference because the stone giants are infamously only in The Hobbit and not referenced anywhere else in any of Tolkien's mythology. And people often think that if Tolkien could have gone back and written another version of The Hobbit, that he would have just written out maybe the existence of the stone giants. Those guys, if you've seen the Hobbit films, the guys that are basically the size of a mountain have this big war where they throw rocks at each other, and the dwarves are all on the side of the mountain, like trying not to get smashed by it. There's this very quick passing reference to stone giants in the Hobbits and in the Hobbit book, and literally they exist nowhere else. So I was like, oh, look at that. They wrote the stone giants into the larger lore by that single little line. So, but Galadriel decides to train these young guys, and Elendil offers a promotion to lieutenant to whoever can get the first score on Galadriel, draw some blood, get some flesh, and that ends up being Valandiel. So he is promoted.
That
kind
of blew my mind, how they were fighting with actual swords, yeah, not like training swords.
I thought that too. I was like, okay, so someone's gonna lose a limb.
Like, right, exactly.
It's like, hopefully, like, y'all, like, you know, I trust Galadriel will like know when to pull her blade, but
exactly,
like, I don't
those
trust
other
these
guys,
young guys to like not cut off an elf's head. Like,
they're all coming at her at the same time. They could accidentally just like into each other.
Yeah, seems a little unsafe. But that's Hollywood.
Galadriel would get an OSHA violation.
So, but yeah, Valandiel is the first one to cut her pretty blue dress. So Kemen goes back and tries to convince Farazan not to do what he's doing. He uses some pretty hard words Farazan doesn't like you're being bossed around by an elf. But Farazan makes the argument, you got to go with the current, man. Like, you can sway things, you can be in control from behind the scenes, but you can't just like throw yourself out there. You got to kind of move with the way things are moving. So we see that even though he was smiling and saying these are the queen's orders at the end of the last episode, he's not totally with it yet.
Didn't he also say something about like looking to the long game?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Because again, he makes the point, you go now,
mm-hmm,
to help the men and make Halbrand king. Now Halbrand's king of the Southlands.
Exactly.
Because of you, and he owes your ass.
Right. We also learned from Kemen in this scene that Farazan was almost single-handedly responsible for the removal of Tar Palantir, Muriel's father, from the kingship, exiling him. So this wasn't just like the people have decided. According to Kemen, Farazan had a plot, and almost single-handedly, and I don't know how many people know this, but according to Kemen, Farazan did it sort of his own accord. Now Farazan says they're going to war because they're saving the low men, and as you said, once the low men are in the Numenorean debt because they now have a king, we also, not only do we have some political sway there, but we also have, and he says, ores, forests, trade, and tribute. And so this is where I go, oh, that's an interesting list. Ores, forests, trade, and tribute. The forest part makes me go, ah, so maybe part of the plot here is Numenor has been stripped of its trees in the building of many cities, and there's not a lot of material to build an entire fleet of ships at this point. And that's a convenient plot point for now, because we want to have few ships so that we can't take this massive army over there for budget reasons on the show, you know? Like, we don't want to get too epic too quickly. So we've got 5 ships to start out with. But eventually, when they get a hold of the forests of Middle Earth, and you've got all the Southerners paying tribute to them, now we've got the material to start building these massive fleets, so that by the end, as we know, there should be masts like forests of trees. Eventually, we'll get
there. They got to start colonizing.
Right, exactly. So that could be a hint to where we're headed.
I still think five ships is low. even if that's what's happening.
Well,
come
and
on.
Of course, by the end, we only have three, so.
Oh, yeah, because they burnt. What? God.
Yeah. So 200 people got left behind. But anyways, Palantir is awake. You know, Dumbledore woke up at the end of the last episode. And so he has a little conversation with his daughter, Muriel. She thinks he's going to be happy. Hey, we're working with the elves. This is what you always wanted. But he's like, don't go to Middle Earth. All that awaits you there. What, father? What awaits me? Darkness. So.
Yeah, that's kind of the gist.
Well, that's kind of what they're going to fight, right?
Right, exactly. It's like, yeah, dad, that's.
Yeah.
That's what's up.
So when we come back to Numenor later in the episode, they're all drinking and preparing for the departure, having a big party. Isildur goes to Valandiel, who is now a lieutenant, and tries to convince him to get him back on the expedition. He's like, you got the power to do that now, right? And the guy's like, no, dude, I'm not doing that. And as his friends leave him, Antimo, his other friend, says, like, I'll take care of Beric. And I'm like, they're taking his horse and they're not taking him. That's a slap in the face.
And he deserves,
like,
it.
He loves that horse so much, right? Like, anyway.
Oh, he's so, a horse boy. He's a rich horse boy.
Yeah.
You're taking my horse.
So Isildur decides he's going to become a stowaway. So he goes and climbs on board one of the ships as everyone else is partying, and he's like tucked away in there. When Kemen sneaks onto the ship too, intending to blow it up, Isildur stupidly coughs really loud for somebody who's going to be a stowaway on a ship.
Yeah, no, he's already.
And then Kemen's like, hello? Is there someone
it's
in
like
here?
It's comedic. It's like, are you kidding me?
What? And then not only that, but man, this is like slapstick stupidity, because then they have a little wrestling match. Kemen sets himself on fire first, and then like Isildur puts him out, and then they run upstairs, and then Kemen runs smack into like a piece of metal and knocks himself out. And I was like, what is happening to this guy? Like, he's so incompetent. So Isildur has to save his life as the ships blow up, and one of them blows up, sets the other one on fire. So two are destroyed. Now we only have three ships, and only 300 people can go to Middle Earth.
I will say, I liked how this ended up playing out, because I thought what was going to happen is they pull them out, and then Kenan was going to blame Isildur for blowing up the ships. He's going to be like, he was blowing up the ship. I saw him.
Yeah, right.
And put it all on him. And then they believe it because, like, oh, he got kicked out of the Sea Guard, and then he wasn't allowed to go, and he's bitter. Yeah, that's what I thought was going to happen. And then and I'm glad they didn't go that route.
That would have been another predictable plot for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead, Isildur covers for Kemen and builds a bit of a bond with him.
They cover for each other, really.
Yeah, right. So now Pharazôn changes his mind. He's told Kemen that he's going to go with the flow. But when he starts talking to Muriel, he's like, you know what? Actually, it might be best to delay this whole thing until we have more support from the people of Numenor. So I don't know what his plan is there. Galadriel comes back to Halbrand to apologize, and she's like, I'm sorry that I used you. That was wrong. She tells him that his voice at the meeting with the queen tomorrow will decide the future of this whole mission, and she pleads with Halbrand to stand with her now. And this is where he says, we've referenced this earlier, he says not long ago, men like him were helping Morgoth. She says, men like you, not you.
Mm-hmm.
And he replies, and here we have big Sauron pile vibes, you're wrong. You don't know what I did before I ended up on that raft. And he's staring into the fire as he says this.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole screen is just filled with flames as he's saying this. And he goes on, he says, you don't know how I survived. And as we mentioned, this is where we're cutting back to the south with Waldreg and the southerners that went with him bowing to Adar. And Halbrand says, how we all survived. When these people discover it, they will cast me out. And so will you. And she says the line that her brother Finrod said to her in the first episode, sometimes you got to touch the darkness, that whole bit. And he catches on. This sounds like there's more of a story here. He asks whose dagger it was that she's carrying around with her everywhere. And she tells him about her brother, that he was killed. And here we get a little bit of an update to the lore, whereas before it seemed like it was being insinuated Sauron himself killed Finrod. Mm-hmm. I love that just this little line is a nice nod to the fans when she says, he, in a place of darkness and despair, he was killed. which is
servants of Sauron.
By servants of Sauron, not Sauron himself. Yes, so we get a lore accurate description instead of what we had before, which is great.
Finrod, yeah, you were salty about that.
I was, yeah. So, and Alex pointed that out immediately when she watched the episode. I was like, ah, nice. The werewolves of Sauron killed him in a pit of despair as he was saving Beren's life. Yeah, so that was nice. Helbrand says to Galadriel, "You're asking me to go back to the one place I swore never to return." Again, this gives me real big vibes of what Gil-galad had said before, that Galadriel may just, she's so fervent about her cause that she may just aid what she's trying to prevent. So if Halbrand is Sauron, this is definitely in the Sauron, you know, or at least this piece of the conversation fits nicely into the Sauron pile for those who want to believe Halbrand has got some Sauron vibes still. If she is bringing him right back to the place where, like, maybe Sauron is trying to have a character arc and he's, like, forswearing all of his evil deeds and he's... okay, and they go on to say, like, in the same vein...
No, I think it's some manipulation there.
But hear me out. Like,
no, I don't want to.
She goes on to say, like, here's the woes of Galadriel, right? Like, her company mutinied against her. Her closest friend conspired with the king to exile her. All because they couldn't tell her from the enemy, right? What if she can't distinguish the enemy either? She's been working with the enemy. She's been aiding the enemy. She's bringing the enemy back to Middle-earth. If Halbrand is Sauron, that is what's happening here. And then he says, in this same vein, he says, "I'm sorry for your brother, for all of it. I'm sorry." And she's like, "Your sorrow cannot ease my pain," right? Because if she can't see him as the enemy in his disguise, "Your sorrow cannot ease my pain because you're not Sauron. You're not the one who did it," right? But oh, Galadriel.
Yeah, he same thought when he was apologizing. But I will say, this seems to feel like a theme they're going into with the show is, like, you can't judge anybody based on, like, assumptions of whether they're good or bad. Because there's so many mysterious figures in here, like the Stranger, Halbrand, Adar, they're multifaceted.
Mm-hmm. "So your sorrow cannot ease my pain, neither will a hammer and tongs ease yours." And I was like, my God, man, if he turns out to be Sauron, he's going to try real hard to ease his pain with a hammer and tongs by creating the Rings of Power. Big Sauron pile. "There is no peace to be found for you here anyway." So the Numenorean storyline then comes back to Halbrand later in the episode, at the end of the episode, when he sets down his little badge thing. Like, he's abandoning the whole whatever, his destiny, returning to the south. But then he comes back and he picks it up and he gets suited up and he's got his armor on and he's riding out with all of them. And they have the big departure parade. And Isildur's here. What the hell? Isildur's back in the whole group. And then we find out, his friend says, "Look whose father secured him a post again." And he's like, oh, okay, Elendil bailed him out again. But there's a twist. Elendil comes on and he's like, "You're going to be cleaning horse shit for the whole voyage."
He also bailed him out because of the whole boat thing. He, like, saved the guy from the boat and the guy made a big deal. It's just like, he could have left me, but he didn't. He kept me alive.
We're not explicitly told that's why.
Elendil gives him, like, a look like, all right. Right,
yeah. I had that same thought, that it's implied, at least, that his sort of quote-unquote heroism.
It's hard implied, yeah.
So yeah, he's going to be cleaning horse poop for the rest of the journey, which was hilarious. I know that it's cheesy and everybody hates these scenes, but when Galadriel comes on board the ship, I still get chills. It's like, it's just cool, okay? I know it's over the top, but the over the top works for me in this show, and those are my favorite moments. So her coming on and all the soldiers sort of standing back in awe as she walks on, and she's like, all right, let's go. It's like, nice, cool. Very fun way to end the episode. And last but not least, our Lindon's story. In the last episode, we knew that Durin was asked by Elrond to come back to Lindon with him, as he discussed with his father. So now we see Durin with Elrond, Gil-galad, and other elves in Lindon, all having a feast, dinner together. And this is where everything starts to go downhill in the episode for me. After the dinner ends, Gil-galad admires Elrond's loyalty to his friend, and Elrond says loyalty should be expected for, you know, this is a friendship. And Gil-galad says, Yeah, even to the point of lying to your king. Elrond says, like, wait, isn't it you lying to me? I went to Durin in friendship, but you had something more tangible in mind, right? You sent me there because you are interested in the discovery of Mithril. And this is where things take a turn.
Just bad, just cheesy and bad.
Gil-galad asks Elrond, are you familiar with the Song of the Roots of Hithaiglir? Hithaiglir is a word meaning the Misty Mountains. And he asks Elrond to recount the story for him. It seems to be an old story. Elrond says, and I quote, an obscure legend regarded by most to be apocryphal. That there is an out in this, in that it's obscure, and to those who know it, they believe it to be apocryphal. Or, you know, apocryphal meaning like a hidden text, a thing that's not really part of the canon. We don't know if it's accurate or not.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that out. If we don't like this story, we can say, well, who knows if that was really true at all. But Gil-galad says, recount it for me, Elrond Peredel. Peredel, by the way, means half-elven, reference to Elrond's lineage. And Elrond says, it speaks of a battle high among the peaks of the Misty Mountains, not over honor or duty, but over a tree, within which some claim was hidden the last of the lost Silmarils. As we talked about in our lore episodes, there were only two lost Silmarils. There were only three ever created. One of them is now being carried by Elrond's father through the sky as the Morning Star. The other two, one of them was cast into the sea, never to be found again. And the other was carried in a suicide leap into basically a lava pit, into the depths of the earth. So each of the Silmarils represents sort of like the sky, the earth, and the sea, elemental representations almost in their fates. But somehow in this lore, one of them ended up in a tree. It's a weird phrase, the last of the lost Silmarils. There were only two lost in the lore. How many Silmarils are we working with in this lore? So a lot of people, when The Hobbit came out, really wanted the Arkenstone to be a Silmaril and came up with these crazy theories like, well, the Silmaril that went into the earth, into the lava, could have traveled through an undercurrent of lava and somehow welled its way up into the Lonely Mountain, and then the dwarves dug it up, and, you know, it traveled across like a whole continent to get there, of course, and it had to have some really strange physical mechanisms to do that. But people are like, yeah, the Arkenstone was probably a Silmaril, not described as looking anything like the Silmarils or having the same kind of power. But people really want to stretch those theories. That kind of feels like what's happening here, where they were like, oh, the Silmarils were like a really cool thing that Tolkien wrote about. We should probably reference them at some point. And we also want to put in this like cool thing about Mithril. We got to make that really important. So how to make it, we should tie it back to something that happened before that was really important. So the Silmaril helped create Mithril. It's like, no, you did not need to do that.
So the whole animation sequence of that scene too is super freaking lame.
Yeah.
Of so, like the back and forth with like the knight and then the Balrog and then the lightning strike. It's just like, are you kidding me?
And I see people commenting like, it's this so is the best shot of the whole episode. And I'm like, literally the worst. I hate it. I hate it. On one side fought an elven warrior with a heart as pure as Manwë, says Elrond. Manwë, this is the second reference to a specific Valar that we've gotten, a specific Vala. Manwë is the king of the Valar. So that's the second mention after Aule of a Vala, which was cool. But apparently this elven warrior had a heart as pure as Manwë. And I'm like, bullshit. I don't like that sentence. A heart as pure as Manwë. Whatever. It's a descriptive phrase. I'll move on. Who poured all of his light into the tree to protect it. On the other, a Balrog of Morgoth, who channeled all his hatred into the tree to destroy it. Now, a lot of fans were really excited when in the trailer we saw a Balrog appear in the sort of post-credits of the trailer that came out during Comic-Con. And they were like, guys, a book-accurate Balrog. It doesn't have wings. Nice! Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings infamously put wings on the Balrog. If the Balrogs could fly, if they had wings, we would have a lot more problems in Middle-earth back in the First Age. And I hate to say it, but in this scene that Alex just described, the Balrogs have wings again. You can see them creeping through the smoke.
Oh my god, are you kidding me?
And I was like, oh, all right, never mind. Sorry, guys. We've got wings on Balrogs. Moving. So there's that.
Maybe they're like flightless. like penguins.
Yeah, I guess they'd have to be. I mean, because otherwise, what was the point of Balrogs the flying dragon? Balrogs
are flightless birds.
Yeah. Amidst their duel unending, Elrond goes on, lightning ensnared the tree, forging of their conflict a power. And I'm like, that whole sentence, just what? So lightning struck the tree that an elf and a Balrog were fighting over, and I guess the tree had a Silmaril inside. So all this wacky power stuff just all and created, went down into the ground and created Mithril. Who came up with this nonsense? This is the kind of thing I was afraid of when they made a Lord of the Rings TV show. Gil-galad says, a power as pure and light as good, as strong and unyielding as evil. They see it seeped down the roots into the mountain depths where for centuries now it has waited. And this turns out to be the whole plot line of Gil-galad this whole time, is that he's sending Elrond over to find this mystical substance that was created from this totally outlandish story.
This story here is stupid enough on its own. And I mean, I didn't even read Tolkien. And even just, like, watching this as a non-Tolkien, like, fanatic, I was like, oh, yeah, it's got to be book accurate, whatever. It's like, this is lame. It's not good. And, so, yeah, I'm also, that's the first time watching the show where I'm just like, oh, like, I don't.
Yeah.
It's not landing. So I don't know who it's landing for. And then they make it worse.
Well, they make it worse. And to be fair, the second part of it that I think is worse, we might have even more of an out for not being true. But this part, I feel like, well, one way or another, we have this really wacky story. And I, it definitely can't be true in Tolkien's universe. But, you know, they've given us the out of saying it's apocryphal. I guess that's the best we'll get. So Gil-galad, after exposing himself as being, like, you know, very interested in the Mithril, Elrond says, Durin was right about you, basically. And Gil-galad replies, then you admit the dwarves did find it, right? The ore containing the light of the lost Silmaril. Once again, I'm like, oh my God, that's what it is now to people. Mithril is just it's just a thing that contains the light of the Silmaril. This is getting wackier by the moment. Like, the Arkenstone being a Silmaril would be less upsetting to me than this wackiness. But Elrond, I mean, by this point, come on, Elrond has broken his vow in all but word, you know. He's basically like, oh, I'm not saying that. I promised Durin never to reveal his people's secret. Obviously, we're talking about Mithril right now. Gil-galad's not an idiot. Gil-galad says, if you're keeping your promise to your... What if keeping a promise to his people meant ensuring the doom of your own? And then we get to even more stupid dialogue. They walk outside to a tree that we've seen in previous episodes, and Gil-galad says, we first took notice of it just prior to Galadriel's return. We hoped that by sending her away and so bringing an end to the last vestiges of war, we might arrest the decay. But despite our every effort, our decline has only quickened. So he's talking about this tree that we saw a creepy black stuff growing across the leaf. They're walking underneath this tree as he's talking. And he's saying, the blight upon this tree is but an outer manifestation of an inner reality, that the light of the Eldar, our light, is fading. Okay, so the tree is a litmus test for elvish immortality, apparently. And as the leaves are dying, that must mean the Eldar are also dying. Okay. Elrond is shocked. Who else knows about this? Gil-galad says, precious few. And I ask again, and for the last time, did the dwarves find the ore or not? What does ore have to do with this, right? What does the Mithril have to do with this? Well, that's what we're getting to. Elrond still refuses to tell him. I swore an oath to Durin. To some, that may now hold little weight, but in my esteem, it is by such things our very souls are bound. I do not intend to let mine slip away on the basis of mere hope. And then Gil-galad says something that sounds very elvish and very Tolkien, but it's in a very sinister way. He's like, hope is never mere, Elrond, even when it is meager. When all other senses sleep, the eye of hope is first to awake and last to shut. If the elves abandon Middle-earth now, the armies of darkness will march over the face of the earth. It will be the end not just of our people, but of all peoples. If the hope of preventing that is not reason enough to make you reconsider your oath, I suggest you find another. So it starts out like, hope is a great thing. Yes, exactly. That's the center of Tolkien's work. But then he moves directly from that in a creepy way into being like, if we don't have, and this is where we're headed, if we don't have the Mithril, then we'll have to leave Middle-earth or die. And if we're not here, then the bad guys win. And so that should be reason enough to make you break your oath to your friend. And if it's not, then you should look for other reasons to break your oath. I'm like, who wrote this dialogue? I don't follow. Then we see Celebrimbor coming to Elrond and apologizing and being like, yeah, I knew about this mission the whole time, this whole secret Mithril mission. And then Elrond's like, this Mithril, it's our only salvation. And he's like, I have tested it under every duress. Nothing diminishes its light. We believe if we can secure vast quantities of it quickly, enough to saturate every last elf in the light of the Valar once more, then yes, it very well could be. I'm sorry.
I've got a couple what's. Like, how has he tested it?
No, I had the same exact thought. Like, wait a minute.
When did Celebrimbor test it? The dwarves just discovered it.
Right, right.
What did you test?
Yeah, I've tested it under every duress.
Also, the elves have to wear this 24/7 for the rest of eternity for them to stay alive because they need them. The light of the... This is all stupid. This is stupid.
So this brings Elrond to a decision he has to make. He says, when Celebrimbor says, I am sorry, he's like, you're sorry for what? That the High King lied to me? Or that now our entire people are doomed unless I break an oath I made to my friend? Cool.
Are you sorry that you're on this show?
Or are you sorry?
Are you sorry that Lord of the Rings the writing is this bad?
Yeah. And now Celebrimbor gives, this is kind of cool. He's like, I don't know if anyone really believes him, but he's like, I was there the night that Eärendil set sail. A mortal man who believed he could convince the gods to come to war, you know, in aid of elves and men. And, you know, Elrond's mother was there imploring him not to go. And he replied he was the only one who could do it. And, you know, the implication being Elrond is the only one who can, I don't know, save the world now. Save elvenkind, which saves the rest of the world. And so it is cool to picture Celebrimbor being there at the scene. But beyond that, there's nothing redeemable from this conversation to me. So when we get to the explicitly worst part of this whole thing, the elves are now carrying this stone table out. Like, Durin makes up this whole story about, like, oh, yeah, that stone is sacred to my people. It's for... Blah,
blah, blah. and it's all like, just make-believe.
He's like, Disa wanted a new table.
And, like, and like, he likes messing with people, yeah, dude. He's...
And the elves are all struggling to carry it. One of them, like, starts to slip, and he's, like, laughing about it. And that's where Elrond realizes, wait a minute. He's like, you made that whole thing up. And I love that joke. That was brilliant.
Dude, okay, he saves the whole thing.
Yeah.
In whose hands?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought it was hilarious. I guess
it's like, kind of whatever.
The premise for why it's there sucks.
Yeah.
But right. For that to be his reaction, mm-hmm. Love it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you know what I mean? Like, I hate that this is the plot.
Yeah.
But
right.
Since it is the plot, his reaction's great.
Yeah. Durin can tell Elrond is hiding something from him. Elrond's got all this stuff on his mind, his conversation with Gil-galad and Celebrimbor. So he says, give me the meat and give it to me raw.
I loved that too.
I was like, all right.
That's... I love that. Enough gravy. Give me the meat and give it to me raw. I forgot about that line.
The fan fiction writers are just going to love that.
I ship them.
Yeah. So.
I need that meme now.
Gosh, it's, yeah. Who is writing this?
Someone wrote that and just like, no one's calling that out. Well, it's staying all right, in.
I guess we're leaving it. So Elrond tells the secret to Durin. He says, you know, I came for Mithril, although I didn't know it at the time. And then he says, you know, what he's learned, the audacious news, without it, my kind must either abandon these shores by spring or perish. Oh, there we've got the deadline again. We've got to get this all done by next spring. Maybe this explains Celebrimbor's hurry, right? Because now we know the plot, the jig is up, right? Celebrimbor has been trying to get Mithril.
I think that was the point of that. Yeah.
So we've got a deadline because the elves will perish. All elvenkind will perish by next spring. Apparently, they can tell this based on the tree meter. in London.
So stupid.
We've got approximately 6 months until all of Elvenkind is wiped out. So we've got to get a bunch of mithril, and then we've got to coat every elf in Middle Earth with it so that the light of the gods will keep them from perishing. Because
also, is that even canon? Okay, because we're like a few steps removed from the light of the gods, because
right.
Feanor.
Yeah, so
made the Cimmerils.
Mm-hmm. From the light of the two trees.
Okay.
And the light of the two trees is created by the Valar.
Right, so that's already two steps removed.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the Cimmerils supposedly got put in a tree.
Struck by lightning.
Step three.
Mixed with Balrogs and Elvish
right.
juju.
And yeah. then sent down into the mountain, where I guess it mixed with rocks or something. So that's step four.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's some rock. It's some shiny rock.
Yeah. Now.
That's what we call a stretch.
Right.
This whole subplot.
All right.
It better be fake.
So here's where I'm going. Obviously, Celebrimbor is the major player here, and the show is called Rings of Power. We don't know what the Rings of Power were made of, so I'm completely fine with the idea that they made the Rings of Power out of Mithril.
Yeah, okay? That's for sure. In fact, I thought they were going to go for that.
Sure. So this is not like the Mithril coat or the Mithril shirt that Bilbo and Frodo wore. I don't think that's the plan. They're not going to make armor to cellophane wrap all the elves in Middle Earth. I think what they want to do, Celebrimbor's idea right now, is to create rings of power that will stop the decay of time. That is canon, right? One of the things that we know about the elven rings in particular is that they slowed the decay of time. But Tolkien did not introduce any other plot line to change the whole sort of biology and immortality of the elves in order to say, well, we've got to slow it down with some rings. They naturally wane over hundreds and thousands and millions of years because they've seen a lot of stuff, and their spirits wear out. Their physical bodies wear out over time. So they're not truly immortal. They have what Tolkien referred to as serial longevity. They can get worn down like a 4,000-year-old tree, like a bristlecone pine, right? They're super, super long-lived, but they still take blows over time, right? And you can preserve a realm for a longer period of time, slow the decay of mortality with elvish rings of power. So it's not too far of a stretch outside of canon to say that the Rings of Power should have some element like that to them. But in the lore, it never explicitly comes from Mithril, and certainly not because the Mithril had any connection to the Silmaril.
Well, it doesn't make any sense either, because supposedly every elf needs this to right. survive.
Which of course they don't. But here's the hope. We're playing right into the showrunner's hands in this. Now, as far as the first part, The story itself, and the fact that the elves would even tell this story to each other, that a lost Silmaril created the Mithril, that part probably isn't going to go away, because it sounds like it's part of elvish history, so we got to live with that one. But the idea of this plot right now, that they believe that Mithril has some power to protect them by surrounding them with the light of the Valar, and that they need this to keep themselves alive and to slow the decays of time, is exactly the reason the elves fell into Sauron's hands. It's exactly that plot, and we're just not... It's amazing to me that we are also falling right into it and being like, what is going on here? Because that's what happened to the elves. Like, surely the elves would never have fallen for it unless they believed there was some peril for themselves, right?
The Mithril thing could be true and untrue. Like, it's true that this story exists, but like Elrond says, it's obscure and most people think it's BS.
Yeah.
And Sauron just happens to know of it and be like, oh, you know that obscure BS story? Oh, it's actually true, and you need this to do all that.
Yeah, so option number one is that everything we've been seeing on screen is true. Option number two, and I think the far more believable one, is that we're being played in the same way the elves are being played by Sauron. Something more sinister is going on behind the scenes, right? And that sinister thing has its own deadline of, we got to have this done by spring, right? This isn't like the elves are going to suddenly perish by spring. Sauron's got a plan, needs to be wrapped up by spring. And he's using the elves. He's convinced the elves that they're going to die by that point if they don't get it done quickly. And that task is, of course, forging the Rings of Power. That means that Sauron is here. He's working behind the scenes with Gil-galad or Celebrimbor or both of them. Or, I mean, perhaps he's a character we're seeing in other parts of the show that we don't recognize as, like, when he's not on screen, he's somehow communicating with them using a Palantir or something. Seems unlikely. I feel like perhaps Sauron just hasn't even been on screen yet, is one option. But regardless, he's here working with Gil-galad, convincing these elves by using fear. Fear of their own mortality, which is a central theme of this show, right? Like, we're constantly focusing on the difference between elves and humans is that humans die and are constantly facing death. Well, now elves for the first time have their own fear of death. What do? They have to create Rings of Power, which makes them fall right into Sauron's hands. In the lore, as we've discussed before, Gil-galad was one of the only elves who saw through Sauron's plan and would not let Sauron even come through the door in Lindon. So, you know, Sauron went to Celebrimbor instead. What's different, clearly, in the show is that Celebrimbor and Gil-galad are working closely together, it seems. So Sauron must be working with both of them. And that might explain some of the sinister feeling of Gil-galad, right? He's just like back in the woods creeping on them this whole conversation, just like standing there like a serial killer, right? So Elrond unloads all of this on Durin, and Durin's like, you'll perish? Perish how? And Elrond explicitly says again, our immortal souls will dwindle into nothing. And I'm like, this is where I shook my head for sure. I was like, no. And again, I'm playing right into it because of course they won't. Like, no, that's such a ridiculous idea. I'm over here thinking the showrunners have screwed up. No, they're doing exactly. I think they're doing exactly what they mean to be doing, which is putting this preposterous idea.
Your immortal soul
has not ever been in jeopardy.
I hope so. I also feel like I don't trust anyone. And it could be that bad.
Yeah. Well, if it is that bad, I gotta say, this is
phenomenally bad.
Yeah. It's phenomenally bad. And there was a question raised on Twitter recently. With all the lore changes that happen in the Rings of Power, right? For a Tolkien fan, everybody's going to have a different scale, a different level, or
like a breaking threshold. Point of how much
yes,
is too much.
Exactly. Yeah. Where do you draw the line? What's too much for you? And I've been wondering that since I saw that question. I'm like, okay, we talked about before, if, for example, they open that little shiny box, the box with the shiny stuff in it, if it wasn't Mithril and it really was a Silmaril, like Alex said, I would have probably just been like, all right, I'm done with this. You know, this is a fun TV show, but I'm out. That was exactly my feeling today when I watched this episode. Like, well, this was a fun ride anyway. I'll watch the rest of it. It was enjoyable, you know, still got some tears, got some laughs. Like, it's not Tolkien to me anymore. But after I cooled off and thought about it later in the day, as many of you maybe have done, I went, oh my gosh, I think I got played, right? The elves' immortal souls were never in jeopardy. They didn't need some shiny magic Silmaril ore to save them. That's, why did we all fall for that? That's obviously a Sauron plot. So if it's not, I really am tapped out. Like, that's it. Sorry, Rings of Power, but it's been fun. So I'm definitely counting for my deep and true enjoyment of the show on that being a false premise. So Elrond, yeah, our immortal souls will dwindle into nothing, slowly diminishing until we are but shadows swept away by the tides of time forever. And he's awfully poetic about this thing, having just learned about it. But that's very heavy for Durin, and of course for us. And he has this big sigh. And he's like, so the fate of the entire elven race is in my hands. And Elrond says, so it would appear. And I literally said out loud at the TV, I was like, yeah, so it would appear, as I was angry at the writers. And then we get the cute moment where he's like, say it again. And he's like, the fate of the entire elven race is in your hands. he loves that. Durin has that moment where he just loves the power. And by the way, we've got all the elves in Middle-earth. We haven't even mentioned all the elves that are in Valinor who are clearly not affected by this. And they keep referring to, like, the entire elven race. And I'm like, there's elves in Valinor that wouldn't be affected at all. Like, and then, yeah, we had Gil-galad creeping in the forest listening to them. And that was the last we saw of the Lindon plot and the last of our coverage of this episode. So we'd love to know what you think of this whole, all the craziness we saw in this episode. There was some of the best stuff I've seen in the show and some of the worst stuff. And what did you think? And, you know, hit us up on Twitter or find us. You can also send us an email if you want. It's historyofarda@gmail.com.
Thanks for listening to History of Arda. Hit us on that Twitter. Tweet us up. What's your crazy theory? Do you think I'm crazy that Theo is Halbrand? I think I'm onto something. Okay, bye.